Good evening, you guys. This is Kilowatt 2, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we run the technical net, as we've done for 35 plus years, starting Sunday night, 10 o'clock, 8 o'clock, usually until midnight, maybe a little bit less than that tonight. Main purpose of the technical net, as you guys already know, is education. We pass information back and forth. The main thing amateurs do is communicate, and we communicate the information of how our radio equipment works and how to make it work better and how to troubleshoot it. So we discuss the propagation and the 27 different kinds of ham radio and transmission lines, transmitters, receivers, satellites, a whole lot of things like that. Radio is a very, very extensive subject, wireless equipment. There's 20 different kinds of wireless equipment being used by the general public. And the modern-day cell phone has really come a long way. Combined with internet, wow, what it can do. Let me drop. One of the big subjects of the last couple of weeks is hurricane in Texas and Hurricane Irma in Florida. It may be even Hurricane Jose. The ABC television and NBC television in particular, and some CBS, has had almost complete coverage all day long from probably 20 or 30 different sites in Florida. How in the world, under all of these marginal communication conditions where, let me drop it, where multiple million people in Florida are now without electrical power, and that probably includes the local cell sites. How in the world are those 20 or so different sites where you've got a reporter standing in front of a bunch of trees that are being blown, in front of rivers, in front of the Gulf of Mexico, the Atlantic Ocean, on Key West? How in the world are all of those personalities with television being relayed back to New York City, by which it's being broadcast, 1,200, 1,400 miles away? How in the world is that signal getting there? That's one of the things I hope we're going to be discussing. One of the people who used to be involved in that was Bill WB2QGZ, and maybe he'll come on later and give us a little bit of a description of how they're accomplishing that. That's really a magic feat. 10 years ago, that would have been impossible. I think fiber optics has a lot to do with it, but that's only part of the story. Let me drop. So maybe downrange tonight is one of the subjects we will be discussing. Other than that, if you guys do have a question or a comment, you're going to sign in at this time, giving me your call letters and your name. Everybody seems to forget that. I like to refer to people by names when I go back to them. So try to remember to give me your name. Try to also delay before you push the button until you hear the four beeps. So the machine and all of its connected IRLP and Echolink all gets a chance to reset. If not, there's a chance the tail end of your communication will be chopped out by way of a timeout. So try to remember the name. Try to remember to wait for the four beeps. I'm going to take check-ins at this time. So if you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
Radio B2GXM, Rich, and yes.
Okay, the B2GXM, we got you, Rich. Who else is going to sign in? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
November 2, Hotel, United Hotel, Handy Andy.
Okay, Rich and Andy. The next person who wants to sign in, please give me your call letters and name right now. You guys are doing a good job tonight.
WS2N, Paul with the space report. Good evening, Dick.
Well done, Paul. Probably Paul will have space report number 267 of the series over all these years. We see 52 of them per year. That's 5 years worth. Wow. Five and a fraction years worth. That guy's got a howdy. I'm having some fun with him. So far we've called, we've got check-ins from Rich, Andy, and Paul. Anyone else? who has a question or a comment on any of the above, give me a call letter and name right now. K2RIW listening.
K2SHO, John from Los Alamos.
Very fine, John, from Los Alamos. That's really down the road a piece. That's a DX station. Modern-day DX station. And how these broadcast signals, how these DX stations get over these great distances with dead cool quieting signals is really something else. One last call in case anyone else wants to join us. If you've got a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. We've got more than enough to get going. Rich, try not to stump us tonight. Go easy with us. Dimitri GXM, go right ahead with your question, Rich. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Tech, Paul, I have a space question. Would you like me to wait till the space report, WB2GXM?
Rich, we're going to make a special exception for you. Go right ahead and ask your question. You got it, Rich.
A2RW in the group, WB2GXM. Simply, does the magnetic field of a planet affect a spacecraft going through it? For instance, when we sent our probes to Jupiter, did Jupiter's magnetic field change their trajectory, WB2GXM?
I'm going to give a partial answer, and then I'm going to turn it over to Paul. Although magnetic fields around Jupiter are extremely strong compared to the magnetic field of the Earth, and that magnetic field, when you go through it, by Faraday's law, whenever you have a moving object going through a magnetic field, a conductor inside of that magnetic field, the conductor that's moving, or the magnetic field that's moving, either one, will induce a voltage. So the magnetic field, the cosmic rays, the nuclear output, that there's radiation coming from Jupiter, all of these things can affect your radio equipment. But in order to steer a satellite, I mean, you know that it took millions of pounds of thrust to get that satellite off the ground from the Earth. And at least thousands of pounds of thrust are used every time you do a trajectory correction maneuver, whenever you try to correct what speed and what direction the satellite is going. It takes thousands of pounds of thrust most of the time to do that. And the magnetic field of something like Jupiter, as strong as it is, could probably exert a couple of ounces of force by way of Lenz's law. If need be, I'll explain what Lenz's law is. So a couple of ounces of force could possibly be exerted on a spacecraft. But the spacecraft weighs thousands of pounds. So the change in the directory, and trajectory, the change in the directory is not zero. It is calculatable. But is it significant? I can talk about spitting in the ocean and then measure how much higher the tide is because I spit in the ocean. By the way, the original statement on that was a lot more obscene. As you can tell, I've softened it. But could you measure the difference in the tide height, even of a lake, because you spit in the lake? There's a calculation you could make, and yes, but is it significant? I think the trajectory change of a spacecraft because of magnetic field falls into that category. That's a guess on my part. Now we're going to get a more refined answer. Paul, WS2N. You've got it, Paul. K2LIW.
Yeah, I would say that it really doesn't have much of an effect, but they do utilize it. You know, let's say you have a satellite staring at the ground, taking pictures, and you don't want this thing to point in a different direction. You want it a certain way as these pictures are being taken. As it goes around and around, they have on the ends of a lot of these satellites, they'll have a coil, magnet torque system. So, you know, they'll energize it, and that will react with the magnetic field around the Earth. And you could actually adjust the the way the spacecraft is looking at the Earth, or at a star, even, you know, if it's looking for an observation like that. But, you know, they do use it to orient the spacecraft. So that will work doing that. They do it quite a bit. They can do it at Jupiter. Whether or not Juno has it or Galileo had it, I don't think so. But they probably could have done that. Juno is presently around, going around a polar orbit around Jupiter. I don't remember them saying that they had that, any kind of magnet torque system. And Galileo, I don't think they did either. But yeah, they do use it, but whether it affects the actual orbit or not, probably not. It must be very minuscule if it did. It would have to affect a piece of metal, you know. Not, a lot of it's made of aluminum or some other kind of metal that might not be as effective as steel. I don't know. I would say probably.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, I'm very glad you brought that up. I completely forgot about magnet torquing. Even though the force you can generate with magnet torquing, in other words, you're applying a current through a coil, generating a cyclic magnetic field at the satellite as it rotates in the magnetic field of the planet. So you could say you're beating one magnetic field against the other, but you're controlling the magnetic field on the satellite, the magnet torquing. So therefore, you could speed up the spin, slow down the spin, change the orientation. And there, even though you're only getting ounces of force, and maybe even sub-ounces of force, you can do it for a long period of time. You could apply your magnet torquing for a solid 4 hours, so to speak, to speed up the spin, or for a solid 20 minutes to change the way the satellite is pointing. You could do that. But in some cases, it requires a fairly strong amount of current to generate a strong enough magnetic field. If you've got a nuclear power supply on board, you can easily do that at the beginning of the mission. Let me drop. If you're flying around the Earth and you've got a good size set of solar panels, you can generate enough power to generate a good set of current. But if you're out at Jupiter or Saturn, where you're getting a very small amount of the sun's radiation, like 1%, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's very small, calculatable by inverse square law, once you know the number of astronomical units out to that planet. Pluto, for instance, 39 astronomical units. Inverse square law means you take 39 squared, which would be close to 1,600, so the solar energy out of Pluto is almost 1,600 times weaker. So you're not going to run solar panels out there. A mile square of solar panels would still be not enough. You have to have a nuclear power supply. So because of the power requirement and the difficulty of getting that power at Jupiter or Saturn, I suspect not very much magnet torquing has been done at those planets. That's a guess on my part. And mention to us, Paul, the fact that the satellite going around Saturn, I think in the next week or so, is about to commit suicide, dive into Saturn to end its mission for a whole bunch of reasons. WS2N for some comments on all of the above. K2RIW and TechNet, you got a ball.
Yeah, September 15th will be the end of Cassini. Cassini was launched in the 1990s, 1997. Took roughly 7 years to get to Saturn. And it's been orbiting ever since 2004. So now over the last 6 months, they've been changing the orbit, primarily using the gravitational pull of the moon Titan. And they adjust the orbit and to the point where going right now, it's below the rings, went through the rings, you know, they're taking chances now because they know they want to get every little last bit of data out of it that they can, and then it's going to burn up in the atmosphere of Saturn. Let me drop it. Now they're doing this because they're basically running out of fuel. There's only so much hydrazine fuel on board, and they don't want to get to the point where there's none left, and now this thing is in a free ride and theoretically could crash into one of the many moons around Saturn, because the spacecraft was never sterilized to the point, for instance, like Curiosity riding around on Mars. They never planned on Cassini, you know, actually landing on a moon, crashing into a moon. They didn't do the severe sterilization process that a lander would go through. So they don't want to contaminate another moon, so they're going to destroy it, burn it up. They've done this before. They did it with Galileo going around Jupiter. Back to you there.
I'm going to add a couple of words to what Paul just said. We have good reason to believe that in the case of Jupiter, the main four moons that Galileo discovered, the Galilean moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, some of those moons are good size. I think it's Europa is the one that's got the ice on the surface and believed to be water underneath that could easily have life. And so NASA's in the talking stage of sending a satellite there to drill a hole for the ice or to go to a place where a geyser is taking place and analyze whether that life is in that water underneath that moon. So you have to be very, very careful that any satellite you send to, say, for instance, Jupiter or Saturn, if it's not thoroughly sterilized, you could be bringing all kinds of microbes from the Earth. If that satellite happened to crash into the moon, when the satellite runs out of fuel, you can't control its trajectory anymore. And so 10 years from now, it crashes into the moon, and some of those microbes, let me drop. Some of those microbes on Earth are very tough. Viruses or whatever, they might survive. And therefore, you're depositing these things onto that moon. At some later time, you go to that moon and look for life, and you'll be very confused if you start finding life from planet Earth that was deposited there by an errant satellite. So you gotta make sure that things are very well stabilized so you don't contaminate a future experiment. I know this is off subject, but those guys in Floral Park, boy, do they ask questions. Back to you, Rich, who lives in Floral Park. W2GXM, Don, good question. K2IW and TechNet. You probably got some more sub questions and fills.
Well, thank you, Dick, and thank you, Paul. Actually, I kind of ran dry on my questions for tonight, but I appreciate all the input on this, so thank you so much. WB2GXM, and clear.
Very fine there, Rich. The next person up at bat is Andy, N2HUH. One of those guys from Richmond Hill. It's not spelled Rich Man, but I pronounce it that way. Rich Man Hill. Rich Pond Hill. You've got it in. K2RAW.
All right, yo, Dick. This is not my original question that I'm thinking of, but I had my roof done yes, a couple of weeks, and I had the old gutters lowered. I went to the backyard, and my idea was those gutters were there for about 40 years, and they had over 10 pounds of dirt inside them. They were clogged. So my idea was to bring those, dig all that dirt out, and see if I could find any meteorites in my gutters that haven't been cleaned in about 40 years. Unfortunately, I didn't find anything, but I thought it would be a good idea to check my gutters. Large surface area being collected there for all those years, but I came up empty-handed.
Well, the method by which you search for micrometeorites, there's a zillion ways of doing it. I think almost half of the meteorites are made out of things that are magnetic. That if you have a real strong neodymium magnet and you wave it over the stuff that's in your gutter and you not picking out the particles that are magnetic. There's a slim chance, a medium chance, that micromedia is right. If they're there, you would select them in that manner. Maybe it's different in your case, but in my case, the leaves off the trees falling into the gutter and decaying are where most of that stuff comes from. I remember when I visited Van, W2OQI, out in Mauritius. He's now a silent key. Let me drop it. But for some reason, I was on a ladder up on his roof, adjusting an antenna. I'm not quite sure what I was doing. This is 20 years ago. And I remember the stuff that was in his gutters was growing a whole bunch of plants. There was the birds had dropped various seeds, so trees and grass and all kinds of things were growing in the dirt that was in his gutters. And it looked like a rich loam soil. In my case, the leaves falling into my gutters because I got a zillion 80-foot high oak trees on my property and tulip trees, things like this. They drop tremendous numbers of leaves into my gutters, which jam up the gutters, and therefore the water overflows and ends up in places that I don't want, like my basement. So I've got to keep my gutters clear. I used to, a couple of times in the year, go up there and manually take the, stand on the roof, squat down, and manually, I can do this on a hip roof what do they call this house? It's a one-story ranch house with a very shallow roof, so I can stand on the roof and squat down and take the leaves out of the gutters. And doing that a couple of times per year is a big job. And I suddenly discovered that Home Depot sells a kind of black triangular-shaped foam that when you put that foam in the gutter, the leaves sit on top of the foam and get blown away, yet the water can go through. It's a beautiful solution. I've tried all kinds of things before. So you might want to review your gutter material and wave a magnet over it, because that's the way that in some cases, I think, they've discovered meteorites. Paul might have a question, a statement on this. Let's see if he does. WS2N, wonder if you've heard the story.
Repeater, timeout.
I wonder if you've heard stories along those lines, Paul. WS2N, wait for the right beeps. I did, KGRIW.
I've never tried it, Dick, but I don't think I waited for the beep. Okay, I've never actually tried it, but I know that I've heard that you could use a good magnet, and you know, sometimes even taking that magnet, hanging from a string, see if there's any kind of movement. But it's gonna be tough, I think. Unless there's something really obvious there. When I moved in here, parts of the property, you know, it was woods at one time before there were houses. And people used to throw stuff there, bed springs and old wheels and tires and God knows what else. So all kinds of weird things were in the ground. So you could go around with a magnet hanging from a string, which I did. Here's something, you know. You dig down, and sure enough, one time I found a wheel from a Volkswagen, you know. You never know what you're going to find, but no meteorites. I know Craig on the astronomy net had a discussion about this once, and he talked about that. But as far as I know, I don't know anybody that's been able to do it. To find them all over the place, they used to go to Antarctica, you know, they'd find them on the surface to have any kind of instrument. They've been laying there for, you know, 50,000 years. Back to you, Dick.
To put a magnet on the end of a string and try to detect metal in the ground, that's one approach. But if you used a real electronic metal detector, I'll bet you that's a few thousand times more sensitive. In the case of finding magnetic particles in Andy's gutter, I wasn't going to use the material in the gutter to deflect a magnet on a string. I was going to do it the other way around. Wave the magnet around the material, hopefully that's dried, in the gutter, and the tiny little meteorite magnetic particles will stick to the magnet, very similar to what they did when the Yig spheres, yttrium iron garnet, Yig spheres that are used in a very fancy microwave filter, and these things are a few thousandths of an inch diameter, a little round black thing, and when one of them dropped on the floor at the company, how in the world do you find something that small that goes bouncing around the floor? Well, they made up a push broom with a whole bunch of magnets along the edge and waved the push broom over the tile floor, you know what I mean, these little 8-inch square type things that are on floors in industrial buildings, and they found the Yig sphere because it jumped up and stuck to the magnet. So I think these particles might jump up and stick to the magnet. It's worth a try, Andy. N2HUH. Looking for extraterrestrial objects. Change your eyes. That's great, Andy.
W2HWW with a question on a different subject.
Okay, I guess let me make sure I have it. Yes, Dick, I forgot to use the magnet, I will admit, but I did use a very high quality discriminating type metal detector, and I was looking for more like pebble size or larger type of objects, and I found nails and such, but I didn't find any meteors in my debris. I'm glad you explained where all that dirt came from, because I didn't think it just flew up there, so I guess that's decaying and leaks and so far and so forth. I still have that soil. I might try the magnet method and let you know if I find any, if I get a bag full of magnetic particles. But no luck, unfortunately. And back to you eventually, George.
NWS2N1, one comment.
Okay, Howie was recognized. We'll get to him in a minute. In the case of a metal detector, it's very good at finding pieces of metal that have the size of, say, a penny or a dime. But you take something that's a few thousandths of an inch in diameter. I don't care what metal it's made out of. I don't think your metal detector is going to detect that. Whereas the magnet might cause the little particle to stick to the magnet. So you get different kinds of sensitivities for different kinds of particles of different sizes using different techniques. Let's see what Andy wants to add to this. I mean, Paul wants to add to this. WS2N, K2IW, go ahead, Paul.
Yes, when I moved in the 70s, the metal detectors weren't, they were invented already, but they were very expensive. So, but as time went on, eventually I did get one. And then you can find smaller things. I mean, I found very small hand pliers, little tiny things, beer caps, you know, when they were made of metal. All kinds of full tops, you know, from beer cans. Just unbelievable. Like you said before, nails and screws. Yeah, it'll go down to a dime. I don't know if you're looking for something a couple of grams big, you're going to have a hard time. But that's a good idea. He had the gutter, so he only had an X amount of dirt to go through. So, yeah, using a strong magnet or even an electromagnet or something to come up with something, that would be a good way to go. But I just wanted to add that. Eventually, yeah, I did there. Wind up with a metal detector, an expensive one.
In Newsday, in the last couple of weeks, there was an article about people who are members of a searching group. I forgot the name of the group, and they meet periodically, weekly, monthly, I'm not sure which, and they're using some of the more modern, very sophisticated metal detectors, and these guys like going to parks and beaches and whatever, and they're detecting things like people's dog tags and engagement rings. They've been finding all kinds of things and returning them to their owners. So these people are using some very sophisticated metal detectors. And I think there's a kind of metal detector that, depending on how you set it, can tell the difference between a magnetic and a non-magnetic piece of material. In other words, find a chunk of aluminum or find a chunk of steel. So those things have come a long way. I've dropped a couple of socket wrenches from my tower doing work, and they fell in various places on my property. I'd like to use a metal detector and go find them, as opposed to just going back to Sears Roebuck and buying more sockets. Let me drop.
Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Andy.
I don't want to say I'm one of the people that you described, but I have been. And I do have a detector that can tell the difference between. I can tell the difference 99% of the time in the ground, the difference between a zinc penny and a copper penny. I would like to say 100%, but it's 100%, but definitely 99% of the time in the ground, the difference between a zinc and a copper. Sometimes I can almost tell the difference between a clad and a silver coin. That's it.
Yeah, I'd like to hear a little bit more about this, Andy. Is it a difference in the tone, the pitch going up instead of going down, or is it a different setting of the frequencies, of sweep or whatever? What do you do with your metal detector to detect the difference between a copper penny and a zinc penny? Over to you, Andy. That would be something I'd like to know. And 2HUH, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beeps. I didn't.
Well, it's as you say. I actually have one of these high-end detectors that you can spend hours programming it. It reminds me a little bit of SDR radio, I guess. But, higher tone, and then you actually, I have two or three different graphs on my, I have a color screen on my unit, and I can set it for icons, I can set it for an actual graph that will, after you actually detect the item, you can actually sweep it to identify it in two different ways, and two or three different type of graphs. And, you know, part of that is how well the unit has been adjusted and how well you read the unit and how well you become one with the unit. But yes, I can definitely tell the difference. And as a matter of fact, this is the same metal detector that I can actually, it actually starts to, let me let it drop one second. On a couple of occasions, I was surprised that if I have it set very high sensitivity, that when the sun is going down, it actually starts to misbehave a little bit. It's happened a couple of times. I haven't never researched why it does that exactly, but I've noticed it happening a couple of occasions, so it's interesting. And I think I've answered your question. So back to you, I'm doing change.
Yes, you did very well. It sounds like you've got one of the rather good ones. I bought one from Radio Shack quite a few years ago, which is not easy to use, kind of troublesome. You're a very nice metal detector that can differentiate copper versus a lead penny, as they call it. What brand name and roughly how many dollars is it selling for today, Andy, in 2HUH? K2RIW. I'm trying to decide if I should go out and invest in one.
Well, it's interesting, but yeah, it's fun too. I'm not sure. Sometimes if you do it long enough, you can get back to what you paid for it. I believe I almost did, or have, but it's white, as in the color white, and this is the name from. I believe that's Oregon, white smell detector. It's top of the line V3i. It has wireless headphones. I believe that sells for approximately $1.5K. Matter of fact, I just turned in all the coins. My old lady uses one, a lower end model, but a good model. And we found over $500 worth of clad coins. I just recently turned them in. Cleaning house here. Over to you.
Very interesting. Sounds like quite a machine. I was a little bit surprised by the price, but Thank you for that information, Andy. Don, good question. Howie, you said you have a question on a different subject. You've got one person ahead of you, John, on the list who already signed in. So I think you're asking me to add your name to the end of the list, right after John. Is that what you mean by a different question? Or was it a different variation of the subject that's on the table, if you know what I mean?
Andy, to the end of the list, I have a question on RCA connectors. Just a curiosity question. WDKHW, back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Howie. Okay, John, you're up at bat. KC2, SHO. K2I, did it wait for the beep, see if it's all right, didn't.
K2RIW, KC2, SHO. Good evening to you, everyone else on the net. Lately I've been studying some things about what the science field does in the RF world. And in many cases, they need a long-distance RF reference source to feed, a bunch of different reasons for this equipment. In our case, it's the linear accelerator's reference line. Some communications applications, they have it as well. I forget the name of the facility. There's one that NASA uses. They have a huge RF reference line there. And controlling the phase along this line is a very complicated thing. Sometimes there are sliding junctions to handle the physical changes in line size, as temperature changes, they heat the line beyond, any possible ambient temperature, make sure that the space is stable from a temperature standpoint. I'm just wondering if you had any comments or ideas on this type of thing, what is involved with making, a half mile long RF reference that is phase stable. And I also see, the Japanese accelerator, they're using fiber optic and doing RF over fiber and then converting back to, back to copper. So that means a whole other issue. If it's too deep for the net, no problem. Just heard not that many check-ins. I always try to come up with something. And that's what I came up with this evening. K2RIW, KC2, SHO.
You're worried that the question to the technical net is too technical. Not to worry. We may botch it up some fears. We may not know what the hell we're talking about. But now, the technical net doesn't turn down any question there. John, stop worrying. We take a hack at any of these. The people I know of that are most phase sensitive on planet Earth, that I know of, are certain brands of cell site portable cellular telephone systems. Some of them, I don't think it's the T-Mobile, but it was another one of the brands that, in order to properly demodulate the highly digitized signal from each of the cell phones, each of the cell sites, particularly the ones that are going to be taking a handoff, they must all have the RF frequency exactly right, and phase of the RF frequency, the phase of the demodulation process, must be properly controlled across many cell sites, across many miles. So, there's the equivalent of a long delay line where at both ends you have to have the exact predictable amount of phase of the reference signal. Let me drop it. In their case, I think the majority of that is done by global positioning satellite system. You use one of the downlink frequencies of the GPS, which is traceable to the Bureau, and except for propagation changes, that signal is accurate to 12 or 13 decimal places in amplitude, frequency, phase, frequency and phase. So if you're two cell sites, let me pick a number, 3 miles apart or 30 miles apart, are both looking at the same satellite, and you know the geometry of the path length, even though the satellite is moving, but you can take that all back out with calculation. So that's one way of calculating phase. And so by setting up a reference frequency and comparing it at the end of your line, that's one approach. to Valerie phase. There's a zillion ways. Let me drop. In other words, if your system has a certain phase response today at this temperature, at this humidity, and so on, and you want to adjust it, a doubly balanced mixer, a pair of doubly balanced mixers with a variable phase reflection on the common IF port can be an electronic phase shifter. There's various kinds of phase shifters that are made with varactor diodes. They're a kind of a filter network where you change the voltage on a diode, it changes the capacitance, it changes the phase that goes through the circuit. So, and trombones, as you probably already know about, in other words, physically changing the length. There probably are ways of coiling a transmission line around some kind of a magnet, an electromagnet, and change the magnetic field. Might be able to give you a minor amount of phase shift. There's lots and lots of ways of creating phase shift in your circuit in order to correct. But to my knowledge, the best phase reference that anyone has come up with is listening to GPS receiver signals with the right kind of receiving equipment. I wonder if you think that would come close to solving your particular challenge there, John. KC2SHO in Los Alamos. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, real good, Dick. I am a bit familiar with that. I used to do some work where we were deploying a single frequency network, DVD single frequency network systems, and all of those are GPS referenced. Our system here is also GPS referenced, but that system feeds the old system, the I don't know how long it is, the half mile long cable that was installed in 1971 or whatever, again with sliding couplers that help us take up the physical changes and things like that. So we do have the GPS reference at the source. Then this line runs all down the tunnel all the way through the whole accelerator, you know. So there are systems in there that are physical, and then they also do some type of feedback and math to that. And like you say, there's trombones on each output to get exactly what you want. That's just the kind of subject that's on my mind, so wanted to see what you and the net had to say about it. And again, I did, the interesting thing I read was that the Japanese accelerator, they're using a fiber optic system, and they have to special make even a phase stable fiber optic cable, or special order, whatever way it is, do RF over fiber, which is very interesting. We did that also in the SSN networks we were building a lot of times because GPS wasn't available at each transmitting site, so to send that down, but yeah, it was more for the timing than for the phase, so it's a subject I want to get deeper into, and I look forward to learning more about it. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
John, I think if you Google the word phase shifter, phase shifting, electronic phase shifting, I think you'll find quite a bit of information. So by doing a internet search, I know you're going to find a lot. Of the cell sites, I'm not sure now, was it Sprint, Nextel, Verizon, T-Mobile? I'm not sure which one. Now, if Bill comes on, WB2QGZ, WB2QGZ, he will be able to tell us, it's WB2QGZ, he'll be able to tell us which of those brand names of cell site requires this extremely accurate phase synchronization. And they've got a backup system which can maintain that phase for a certain period of time if the link to the GPS satellite is broken for some reason. It sounds to me like you're working on a major accelerator. What's the name of the accelerator you're working on, John? And is it doing particle research? KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, one of the nice things about working at the accelerator here is the way accelerators work and the functioning and the backbone of the accelerator. This stuff is not classified information. Matter of fact, most of the accelerators collaborate, which is really nice. It's the science that's done at the targets that are the things that are a little more sensitive, and I don't deal with that. the Los Alamos Neutron Science Center, something like that. The acronym is LAND. And you can look it up on the Los Alamos site. Lots of information there. And there's tons of RF in these accelerators. It's a dream job, really. Getting to play with interesting things and learning a lot. And having, mentors and who are both of you are very smart with this stuff. It's easy to just kind of absorb and take it in. There are 48 transmitters in the accelerator and put energy into the line. And they all have to be resonant within 0.1 degree of phase, which is not too bad at 201 megahertz, which there are four of. But it gets a little harder on the 805 megahertz. So look it up, check out the site, you might find it interesting. A lot of times the RF portion is overlooked when we talk about the accelerator. It doesn't work without it, but how the energy is added to the beam. And is it it's a proton beam, if that helps the understanding, if you need more info, I might be able to help, but I'm surely not the best person to explain it, although I think I have a reasonably good understanding. K2RIW,
Very fine, John. In order to learn what's the state of the art of particle accelerators, I recommend you get a hold of a not very expensive book called LHC, Large Hadron Collider. I have a copy of it sitting right here. I'm going to find out the author's name. It's the Quantum Frontier is the name of the book about the Large Hadron Collider by Don Lincoln. It's a Johns Hopkins book, very well written. There also was a website that a bunch of us on Long Island passed back and forth to each other. If you Google the word LHC, Large Hadron Collider, you will find a beautifully well-written article. I'm guessing it's about 7 or 8 pages by one of the scientists at the LHC. Extremely well-written with nice illustrations. That takes the general principles of particle accelerators. Let me drop. And explains them. I may mail you that URL for this beautiful article. But again, if you do a search on Large Hadron Collider and explanation, I'm pretty sure you'll find it a very well written article, worth reading. And each of us who read it, at the time that we read it, we thought we understood it, and we said, oh, is that how it works? Is that what it's doing? And so I'll try to find that again and mention it next week and maybe mail you a copy of it if I can find it. It's worth reading. And the way that article is written, in a half hour or an hour of reading the article, you'll learn what you would have learned in class if you had spent 3 months in class, if you know what I mean. It's that well written. So I do recommend you look for that if you don't already know the one I'm talking about. If I had a much better memory, I would be able to tell you the title and the author. But it is one of the scientists at LHC that wrote this beautiful article. Please come back next week or in whatever weeks that you find more about phase matching. Let me drop. I am guessing what's going on here is that at multiple places around the ring, assuming this is a ring accelerator, assuming your lens is a ring accelerator, that at multiple places you have an RF circuit that boosts the particles at that point. And of course, all of those individual boosters around the ring have to be synchronized in such a way that they boost the particles without scattering them. And in order for you to get luminance, I think it's called, you're trying to keep your particles very tightly bunched and some extremely good phase matched boosters, RF boosters, are required to do that accelerating. Is that approximately what's going on here, Lance? KC2SHO in Los Alamos. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Forgot about the beep, so let me make sure I have it. Stand by. Okay, as I look at the lights on the node here, make sure I had it and someone else wasn't talking. But yeah, you've got it pretty much on point, except that here it is a linear accelerator. So it's a little under a mile from the source where they put in the positive and negative hydrogen ions and bunch them up together, send them down the line. And along the line, in all of these 48 RF cavities, the beam passes through the middle. And, well, that's not totally true. In four of them, it passes through the middle. In the other 44, it's a little more interesting. If you look up the difference between a drift tube linear accelerator and a side-coupled accelerator, we have both. The lower frequency system, the 201 megahertz system, is a drift tube, and the rest is a side-coupled. But anyway, it's all linear. And as it goes down the line, yeah, the RF adds the energy to the beam to speed it up to near, I think it's about an 88% speed of light, and 800 mega electron volts, something like that, that they get out of the other end when they have maximum power. Pretty good description you got there, Nick. Very good. K2RIW, KC2, SC2.
And the lens, 800 MeV, is a relatively small fraction of what the Large Hadron Collider can do. But the Large Hadron Collider only cost quite a number of billions of dollars. And it's a ring that covers up, I think it's 27 kilometers of circumference, goes across two or three different countries. A huge endeavor. The United States was going to have the superconducting supercollider in the Texas area. I'm very disappointed that that was discontinued. Although at the time, not enough research had taken place on superconducting magnets, which are required for the whole thing to work. Without the superconducting magnets, you don't make the superconducting supercollider or the Large Hadron Collider, you don't make them work without very well-performing superconducting magnets. So X number of years downrange, let me drop. So years downrange, when the United States had already built a whole lot of biological scanners, I can't think of the name of the things, you know what I'm talking about. They require a superconducting magnet of 3 Tesla, 7 Tesla, depending on how much resolution your nuclear magnetic resonance machine is, what it used to be called, magnetic resonance imaging, MRI. But it really is nuclear magnetic resonance. They had to change the name because people would get scared when they hear the word nuclear. And in the case of our world, the ham radio world, you can talk about nuclear radiation, and you can talk about RF radiation. And boy, do people confuse those. One of my relatives lives in Bayville, Long Island, but Bayville is just one of the many places where the people are very afraid of RF radiation, and they want all the cell sites to disappear. They want all the antennas in their town that are supporting fire, police, ambulance, and so on. They want all those antennas to disappear. So if the people in the town are convinced that it's creating biological damage, there's a whole lot of reasons to believe that this is in error. But when people come up with a belief, let me drop this. When people come up with a belief that RF radiation is cancer-causing and that the astronauts never went to the moon, it was all a Hollywood production, and this is the Flat Earth Society, and there's a number of places where people have developed strong beliefs, and it's very, very difficult to correct those beliefs. So nuclear radiation, RF radiation, and so on are some of these subjects. Why can't I think of the third one? It'll come to me later. So do search for that article, Lance, and as I said, if I find it, Christian, John, if I find it, I'll mail you a copy. Any further questions before we go to, any further fills required, John, before we go to the next questioner? KC2SHO, I'm glad you signed in. And come back and tell us what you find and all of the above. K2RIW, back to you, John.
Very good, Dick. As we get settled here, it's getting easier to find time for stuff like ham radio, although really all I have at the moment is handhelds and the IRLP node. But that's good for now. Got to get a little more active with the local group. Matter of fact, they have an 8 o'clock net here. So in another hour, I might check in there and see how they do. Real good. I'd love to... I'll search for the article, but if you have it, yeah, please send it. My email is good on QRZ. And, there's lots to learn. I'll try to be an active participant here whenever possible. And always love the net. Appreciate everything you guys do. There's always great information and much to learn. It's amazing how deep the subject of RF alone can be. You know, I've been doing this since the early 2000s, been interested in it. So I first realized what radio waves were as a very young teenager, and still fascinated today, so it's the longest-term hobby, probably. There you go. K2RIW, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. KC2SHO.
In the case of the RF hobby, John, there is no end to it. If you had asked somebody... and we discovered everything we want to discover about the RF wave itself in, say, 1970. Quite a few informed people would say, yeah, we've discovered almost everything we want to know about RF. We're going to come up with better and better circuits, transistors, and whatever to generate it and receive it. Well, here we are with a weak signal and Joe Taylor. There's now 27 different kinds of ham radio. And Joe Taylor is coming up with more and more digital techniques for very specific applications, so there's no end to it. Another way of looking at RF is that the wave itself that's traveling through a vacuum, not a single electron leaves your transmitting antenna. Not a single electron from that wave in space jumps onto your receiving antenna. So no electrons are there. And yet we call it an electromagnetic wave. We think it's got an E field and an H field. I know it has an H field, as you guys have heard me say so often. I'm a little bit doubtful as to whether or not the E field is there. How do you generate an E field without charged particles? Let me drop it. By Faraday's law, if I've got a changing magnetic field that encounters a conductor, like an antenna or a coil, yes, the changing magnetic field will induce a current or a voltage into a conductor. So the magnetic field will do that. Did the magnetic field that did that, was there an electrical component in itself? I think the answer is no. But I'm bucking an awful lot of strong beliefs by a whole lot of people. By the way, I thought about the other thing about what people have trouble with. People have trouble with, did NASA and the Apollo program really go to the moon? People have trouble in the old days with the Flat Earth Society. Whether or not RF energy... creates a biological hazard. And nowadays you have a huge number of people who believe that vaccines given to children are dangerous and they create autism, even though there's a tremendous amount of evidence saying no. And people will use as an excuse, well, for a lot of years we thought asbestos was safe, we thought cigarette smoking was safe, and we found that it wasn't. And they believe that in some number of years we're going to find out that RF is not safe. Well, we've been studying RF for 60 solid years. I'm just talking about the American National Standard Institute C95 report. Let me drop it.
XM.
Okay, somebody was quick on the switch. I only heard XM, but I'll go to you in a second. What was I saying? Lost my train of thought. Mr. XM, whoever you are. You were adding a comment to all of the above. Give us the full call and your name, sir. Maybe it's Rich, K2LIW.
WB2GXM, Rich again. You know, Dick, if we use a strong enough magnetic field on those all those people who want the antennas to go away, we could change their minds. WB2GXM out.
Yeah, a real strong magnetic field that changes at a particular rate can, by way of Faraday's law, induce voltages in anything.